on Polaroid 809T. At that time, the 809 Polaroid Polacolor was supposedly the most stable of the color processes because of its metallized dyes. And so I took the job and I went down with a whole team of archaeologists and we photographed every square inch of this cave with an 8x10 Sinar. They built scaffolding for me so that I could just move, take a picture, and move exactly so many feet. Every picture was made on the Polaroid and there's color corrector with a Moncel color system. And I didn't do the correcting, the anthropologists would do it. And the graphic artists, and they would say, no, it needs, it isn't this hole in the cardboard, it's this one. So they bought me a complete set of 5x5 color correction filters. And they didn't know what that cost until they got the bill. But I had them, and so it meant that I could make adjustments down to 2.5 units. And so I did the whole thing, and it was for preservation. But when we got it up, then they decided that maybe it should be a traveling show. And so they put it together as a traveling show for a year that the state did. And then that literally started me getting more and more into rock art, even though I'd been doing it at that time for some 20-odd years. I had never really seriously been after any recognition or display. And the whole thing was for public awareness. It didn't go to museums. It went to public libraries and shopping center malls and any place where there was high foot traffic. And when we were finished, the state gave that to the Steinbeck Center, the whole show. So you never know where things come from. So then all of a sudden, here I got a connection with the Steinbeck Center that I never had before. But the rock art thing is so intertwined with people that love the landscape. Because you find when you go to this little canyon, say half a mile long, in a pretty raunchy part of the state of California. But that canyon is pristine. There's no vandalism. There's no waste material. No one's violated the canyons. They figure that the Indians probably lived there in excess of 1,000 years, yet there's no trace of them except for the rock art. They were stewards of the land. And so it's one of the things that you have the opportunity to push on. Is that we don't have to tear things up. And here's the proof of it, that these people were around for a long time. In one of the main canyons I go into, and Steve's been there with me at China Lake, they thought that the inscriptions there at China Lake were approximately 1,000 years old. And when then they got into carbon dating, and they found out that some of them were 12,000 years old. And that's just a scientific fact. So it gives us a chance to go back, way back in history, and get a better grip on what the hell's going on. One of the things that I'm very keen on is if you look at most of the books about, especially Indians in California, Kroeber being one of the biggest examples in Berkeley. They talk about California Indians as being illiterate, crude, and not worthy of study. And I can show you his book right over there, in which that's on the first page. Well, no one does this kind of work that is crude and illiterate. You pick up a rock and try to do this yourself sometime. And I look at them and I think what I've learned about it is that our society and our culture goes back a long ways, and it wasn't always Neanderthal. There's some pretty intelligent people back there, and they did some remarkable things. And I'm absolutely delighted to photograph it. I don't try to enhance it. I try to keep it as straightforward as possible. The idea in composing a photograph is not to alter it, but just to take what's there and put it forward in the strongest way possible. And so all my early work was black and white, and all some of it still is. Most of it's now color. And what interests me most is, Steve and I both know a color lab in SoCal called Laser Light. And they have one of these big scanners for copying paintings. It has a throat on it that's about 30 inches. And you put a painting on this platen, and that scanner goes across the top of it, does a painting that's as big as that poster, and you can't beat it. The quality is incredible. You know? And so if I'm to continue this, it has to be digitally, because that's the most accurate. The most accurate. So you go out there with the idea that you're going to make photographs for yourself, and this is part of your portfolio, and you know, hopefully it'll be called fine art. But to me, it's very important that it be literal, that it be honest and straightforward. I very rarely make a photograph of the rock art in which the camera is tipped, for instance. I always square the camera up. My sign art has 6 levels on it, and I'm checking all of them all the time to make sure. My Hasselblad has got 2 levels on it. Is I don't want to just I don't want a distortion at all. That's part of the smile to me. When I have a show in Idaho, no one sees that. But I know it. And that's what's important. So a little bit of rock art, and once in a while maybe an article for Architectural Digest, and a few talks here and there, and life goes on. And it's good.
You feel like talking about the Finnish architect project or what?
I'll be glad to. I went to Finland in 1989. Architecture Magazine was going to do an article on Scandinavian architecture. And the writer had already been and done the writing. And the magazine turned down one building, and which I mentioned in Rovaniemi and the Arctic Circle, and the reason they turned it down is the photographs weren't good enough. And so I knew the writer, and she was very upset about it, and she talked me into going to Finland if she could get my expenses paid. My transportation, my housing, my travel, and all that kind of stuff, and do the building on spec. And that way she could get it in the magazine. Well, she not only was persuasive, but she was rather attractive. And I thought spending 2 weeks with a nice-looking lady in Finland doesn't sound like such a terrible thing to do. But Susie and I were talking about, Susie is my wife, and I said, you needn't worry, she's not going to be able to come up with the money to cover this. Never underestimate a woman. 2 or 3 months.
Why are you pointing at me?
Well, these two know. 2 or 3 months later, she walked in the door right there and slammed down an envelope on the counter and says, here's your tickets to Helsinki, and here's the address of your apartment while you're there. And so I went to Finland and photographed this building. And if you don't mind, I'll bring one of the prints out. I don't bring a lot of them. I'll bring one of the prints out. The Finns. In Finland, there never was a Second World War. What they call that time period is the Winter War, because it only lasted one winter before they were massacred by the Russians. But in losing to the Russians, they took a lot of Russians with them. The Finns are a fierce, fierce nation. And they had destroyed the city. And what the government did, the Finnish government did, was they rebuilt the city, but they rebuilt it with rubble. They literally took the bricks and the stones that were just lying around, and they built the buildings from it. And then one of them was built as a tramway center, and they took that building and decided to make an art museum out of it. And when they were finished, it was ranked as one of the 40 important art museums in the world. And being on the Arctic Circle, the storage conditions were absolutely perfect for the storage of fine art. And so much of Finland's national collection is there, the Rovaniemi Museum of Fine Art. So I went there to photograph the museum and did that, but got intrigued with the architect. His name was Juhani Palisma. And the longer I was around him, the more I liked him, and I really liked his work. There's just something about the austerity and cleanness of all Scandinavian architecture. I don't care whether from Denmark or Iceland or Norway or Sweden. It's all so far advanced over what we have. They refer to us as Disneyland. And rightfully so, you know. When you're in a Scandinavian country and you see a new building, it is nothing but sheer class. So after I finished doing the museum, I was sitting around waiting to fly out, and the writer approached me and said, how would you like to come back to Finland next summer? And maybe we should do a book on Palisma. So I went back 2 more years and did quite a few projects for Palisma. In doing that, became very close with him and his family. And Finland has a national museum of architecture. We don't have such a thing. There's no such museum in the United States. But Finland has a museum for architecture. When they found out what I was doing, they gave me a darkroom. And they gave me a secretary. And a telephone. And a storage place. And when I wanted to unload my equipment in the night, their custodian came out to the car and helped me carry it into the building. And all they asked for that was occasionally making us what they would call just a snapshot for them. Well, I did a lot of snapshots for the Finns because they were just damn neat people. But every time they sent me out like this, the one black and white on the left, that's called Resurrection Chapel. It was built during the Winter War. And it's a chapel. And so it was never bombed or fired upon. But it was actually a munitions plant. And so they wanted pictures of that. That's one of the interiors of it. It's in the original capital of Finland, which is called Turku, which is right across the archipelago from Oslo. And you get in a building like that, and the feeling is the same as when you're in the canyons above Barso. It just consumes you, you know. I would get over there. I wouldn't come out for lunch. I'd stay the whole day from early morning until late and just stay and stay and stay and stay because the place, their architecture is just, it really is, it's such a cut above everything. And but when I got there to that project, this chapel, I did a few things in color, but very few. Almost all of it was black and white because I felt black and white was the way to go. And it's been pretty comfortable. I would like to show you, I'm thinking about what's the easiest way to do this.
Can we help? One of the prints or some of the books?
We never got the book printed. The closest we got was a publisher in Germany, and the bastard died before we got it done.
So, I hate bastards that die.
Yeah, I thought they were pretty chintzy. I mean, is it over? I have to kind of look. Okay. I don't know if I can go over there. You know, my biggest complaint about
flat files?
About digital prints, the fragile quality of the paper.
Yeah, we don't have to print it on that kind of paper.
Well, that's something I've got to talk to you and Eric about.
Yeah.
Because it's almost impossible to get a print like this delivered without some kind of a DMD in it. This might be...
This looks like a building.
That's one.
For a dollar a mile?
Yeah. This is not that building, this is a different church in Finland.
Oh, that's one that's on the card. Oh, no, it's not.
I think I showed them last night, didn't I? Here it is.
It's on top of it.
This is the museum in Rovaniemi. The ceiling is spruce cut right on the property. The floor is granite, quarried right in the backyard.
You guys may have picked up on the fact that I think this is important work.
There's one more, I think.
Can you take that one out?
It's okay.
Yeah.
This is lovely.
Yeah, that picture of Colorado.
Those mine tailings?
Yeah, mine tailings. They're gone now. Yeah. What they've found in Colorado is that they take those mine tailings, scrub them, and use them as road base. This is contemporary. This is the courthouse in a little town on the Russian border called Kropio.
You notice the precision that Al did these with. Just extraordinary attention to symmetry, the elegance of the design.
Perfect.
The photography became almost as precise an act as the building.
Yeah.
I think there's one more that I wanted to get to.
Let me just pull these out. That one?
Yeah. In downtown Helsinki, all the buildings face the street, and in the middle of the block is the alleyway, and that's what this is, and that's where all these deliveries are made. Well, now because they're running out of space, they're taking those alleyways and making restaurants and coffee shops and things like that, and that's what this is. In Helsinki.
Looks like we hit the gold mine here. Huh?
This is a church in I forgot the name of the town. I probably couldn't pronounce it anyway.
So these are all made from scans. So the scans already exist on these.
Yeah. Right. So you know we're all concerned about the stability of film. Well, at this point, I don't know how stable the scans are, but I'm sure they're going to last longer than the film will. Then, while I was there, you, honey, wanted me to photograph the home of Finland's number one painter. Mm-hmm. So it took us almost a day and an 8-foot skiff to get out to this place. Juhani designed it for him. It's his studio. He lived there with a very fast sailboat and a faster young lady. And this was it. And Juhani designed the place for him, and then went out and the two of them built it.
The fast young lady and the painter.
Yeah. I think she just watched.
Yeah.
Wow. Juhani said, that's very common that he get involved with a project and just put down his stuff, pick up a hammer and saw, and go to work. And this is just a detail of that one courtyard. It's all very simple, but geometrically, it's all perfect. These are enlargements, and these are door poles. if you hire an architect in Finland and you got cabinetry, they don't buy the hardware at a store. They design the hardware, and Helsinki has hundreds of small foundries. And you can have this kind of thing made almost as cheap as you can buy off-the-shelf stuff here.
Really?
So they're really into ergonomically proper things. So this was some of his
poles. There's no more in that stack. Yeah. Should I put these back on top, and then you can keep the architecture ones
and
on top of it?
We're going to leave them out. I'm going to use them. You can leave it, Steve. I'll do it later.
You don't really want to, do you, Ken?
No, that's all right.
Shouldn't I just do it, or would you rather do it?
You can do it.
Okay. Because that way you can keep those separate.
Well, I just wanted to give you a slight idea of Finland. I've never been back, and I doubt if I'll go back. I think.
On the other hand, the photographs exist, the text exists, and I want to see if I can help push this one along a little bit.
Well, you know, I'm always open to that, but the other thing, realistically, another mission will come along, so it's a matter of priorities, and sometimes you get into something and you really think wisely about it. And it's very important, but it turns out not to be that important. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you think, sometimes it's just best to close the door on something,
We don't want to stay too long, Al, but there is one other thing that I think people would benefit from knowing a little bit about, and that's the Friends of Photography.
Oh, boy.
Well, you don't have to, but if you want to take on why it started and sort of your involvement in it. You don't have to go through the ending of it, but...
No, Friends of Photography was an organization that started here in Carmel in 1967. And the original idea was Cole Weston's. And he wanted an organization to show his father's work. And he took the idea to Ansel, and Ansel proceeded with the idea, and Weston was kind of pushed out of the way. He never participated in Friends anymore. The original purpose was changed. Edward was shown, but he was not featured at all. And everyone was happy. No one was mad about that. It started at the Sunset Center downtown in Carmel, which is, you say you're going to see that?
Tomorrow.
Yes. It's exactly that space. And initially, it was, Ansel was the president, of course, and Garrett Weston was the vice president, and Win Bullock was the vice president, and Beaumont and Nancy Newhall were involved, were on the board, so was Minor White. Robert Weinstein from Los Angeles, who was with the County Museum, I think it was in L.A. Lily Andy Koch and Geraldine Sharp, who's thing here. Donald Ross in Berkeley. And Rosario Watsayo from Boston. And they started this organization, which is a lobby group for photography, with the whole idea. And it started in Carmel, and initially the idea was they were going to form chapters. There would be a chapter, the mother chapter in Carmel, and then another chapter could be started any place. It would be maybe Los Angeles or San Francisco or New York. Well, the chapter idea was shot down, mainly because Ansel didn't want to lose control. Friends of Photography started with Ansel and ended with Ansel, and without him, it never would have been, and without him, it never would have run. He was the driving force. He was the intellect behind it, and he also was the money behind it. When friends got a little broke, it was always Ansel who ponied up a few thousand dollars here and a few thousand dollars there to promote it. And so it ran in Carmel from 1967 until the early 80s. I don't remember exactly when it moved to San Francisco.
About 85, I think.
Yeah, so in 1985. Initially, it was supposed to go to, what's that center down the water?
In the water.
The old camp fort.
Fort Mason.
Yeah, they had chosen a 25,000 square foot building down there, and actually it had architects redesigned the building, and that's where they were going to go. But along the way, they seemed to lose sight of the original goals. Part of that was Ansel, of course, died in 84, and instead of doing things for young experimental photographers, all of a sudden they were in golf tournaments and Pebble Beach. And it ran for maybe another 5 or 10 years and then folded. All of us around here were a party to it. I was pulled in on the board for two things. Number one, I had the degree in education, and they wanted me to design and run their workshops, which I did for 7 years. But the main reason they wanted me was I was the only commercial photographer, and none of the rest of them knew how to copy. None of them did. They couldn't make a copy print for Sauer or Alter, you know. So I have all kinds of negatives of original work. And to a commercial photographer, copying is a bread and butter thing. Mm-hmm. It's something that you do. That black wall back there, that's what that black wall is for, is a background for copying. And the smiler on that is that I have a file of copy negatives that if I ever decided to plagiarize, one year I'd done an Edward Weston nude, and I got Cole's permission, and I put out a copy print for Christmas presents to my friends only, and on the back was a rubber stamp that said, "This is an original fake fraud." But you couldn't tell it from the original. Kodak's copy film was so good. And that was my role, was to make copy prints and run the workshops. But there was a lot of stress. It started off with the first shows. The first show was people like Imogen Cunningham and Ruth Bernhardt and Minor White, Barbara Morgan, and of course Ansel and Edward and Wynn and people like that. But when we hung the show, everyone was down there washing glass and driving nails. And we'd have to watch out for people like Wynn Bullock, because every time he'd pick up a piece of glass, he'd cut himself. And so, but they were all there. I can remember Nancy Newhall polishing glass and Ansel arguing about the placement of a print or something like that. And those were the fun times. They were really, really great when everyone would get together, and then before long someone would come out with a bottle, and then pretty quick it was time to quit because no one could see what they were doing. But we had a lot of fun, and I think we did some good. But when it moved to San Francisco, it seemed to go downhill. And Ansel, in the meantime, took on a business manager because he was didn't feel like, I guess, he was making enough money. And his business manager cured that. He made Ansel instantly very wealthy, but then had a huge input on Friends of Photography, and to me, destroyed the spirit of it. Everything was done for money. And the more they specialized in money, the less they got. Because most people that are philanthropists are rather offended by that kind of thing. And so all of a sudden, big donors weren't coming through with money because they were frosted with some of the attitudes that were coming out. So there was a meeting in Carmel in the early 80s, and it was to decide the future of Friends of Photography. At that time, it was maybe 15 years old. And everyone got up, Peter Bunnell got up and gave this long speech about what he thought Friends should do. Bob Heineken did. And Minor White got up and said, "We've done it, let's close the door." And Minor White was the one that was right. So they laughed him out. "Oh no, we have lots more we can do." But the fact is, they didn't do anything after that.
Was that after Ansel died? Was that after Ansel died or before?
I'm sorry.
Was that meeting after Ansel died?
No.
It was before.
No. Ansel directed the meeting.
Okay.
Oh, it was before 1984.
Okay.
But Nancy Newhall and Beaumont were there, and Minor. Wynn was dead by that time, but Brett Weston was there, of course. Bob Heineken was there, and Peter Bunnell, Morley, Richard Garrett, Henry Gilpin, Bob Byers. And Ansel retired as president, and they voted in a new president named Bill Rusher, who was just retired executive from what's the big tower and pyramid tower and
Transamerica?
Yeah.
Transamerica.
He was just retired president of that. So now all of a sudden, instead of having an Ansel Adams running the show, he had an insurance executive running the show. And, of course, I'm very prejudiced, and you understand that. And I'm very open about being prejudiced. But in my opinion, Bill Rusher did more to destroy Ansel, the whole thing, in a short period of time with his insurance mentality. It just went down the tubes.
On the other side of the equation, while they existed, they had a quarterly newsletter,
yep.
A great deal of book publications, workshops for over 10 years,
yep.
With some of the finest instructors coming in from all over the country, great people helping to run it, like Swanee.
Yep.
And,
very true. While it ran, it was really a runner.
Yeah.
But one of the workshops that Fred Parker designed, and Fred was the first executive director of Friends, and he now has a nice little gallery up in north of Napa. He's a painter. It was called The Creative Experience. And Jerry Ulson was part of it, Ralph Gibson was part of it, and TNT was part of it out of San Francisco, the new theater. Allen Ginsberg was there. And it was a pulsating collection of all these artistic types, and it was incredibly successful. And the next year we went to Planet again, and Bill Rusher came into the meeting and said, "I'm here to make sure that you don't hire any more of those freaks." So in those days, when we did a workshop, we put all the staff up with us. We'd take them in. We didn't put them in a motel. Well, Bill Rusher got stuck with Allen Ginsberg. And it just was more than he could stand. And it probably was the highlight of our day. But it's true. We did. They did. The Friends did a lot of good things. But the biggest problem was, as I saw it, there was a slogan that went around Pacific Grove, which has quite a underground movement of young artists in all forms, musicians and poets and painters. And they didn't call it Friends of Photography. They called it Friends of Some Photographers. And that was very true. Very true. It was very politically minded. So, well, I don't know.
You guys think of anything else you'd like to ask Al about? One of the things I wanted to point out is you'll notice a few handmade wooden cameras up there. Those are handmade aerial cameras.
Yeah.
That Al had made for him to be able to do aerial photography the way he wanted to do it.
I've never found a camera yet that quite does what I wanted it to do. And several years ago, I I fell in with a physicist at the Navy postgraduate school whose job was to run the linear accelerator. You get the postgraduate school has Stanford's first linear accelerator. And Fred Buskirk ran the accelerator, but he also loves photography and he can build anything. So I would want a particular aerial camera and he would build it for me. And the little camera on the left is a 5x7 and the one on the right is a 4x5. And both of them have lenses that have been run through an optical bench to make sure that we got the maximum quality we could out of the glass. And they really work. They work very well. Before that, I used old K20s, like up that black one up there. I think Stephen used those too. Yep. Those are military surplus cameras. They use 5 1/4 inch film, and the film was 20 feet long a roll. It has 50 exposures in a roll. And it was a little awkward to handle, but the big problem was when Kodak quit making 5 1/4 inch film.
So what I did for mine is I had the 5 1/4 inch take-up reels, had shims put in each side so that I could now use 5-inch roll film. So 8-inch shims on either end of the spool.
Since we're talking about handmade cameras, I have to show you one more. I should see you have seen this. This was built for me by Ralph Putzker.
No, I haven't seen this though. It's quite a shutter.
It's a pinhole camera.
Or a plaything. Okay, somebody's got to get a picture of me and Al and Ralph's pinhole camera.
Did you say it's a pinhole or penal?
Panoramic film. Yeah. In this case,
so it's four by 10 inches. The film, it's held in by the curvature of the thing. You put the lid on. And it really works. Yeah. Well, Busker, because I spend a lot of time on landscape. It's ready for the landscape. And of course, this part up here, if you look at it, it's an incredibly accurate viewfinder.
Who built that?
Ralph Putzker, the fellow who the trophy and the picture that I passed.
It was at San Francisco State.
I have to say, and I don't think Al will disagree, the finest teacher I ever met.
Oh, yeah. Ralph died 2 years ago, 3 years ago, 3 years ago.
It's now been, I think, almost 4 or 5, actually.
No, 2 or 3.
Okay. We'll say 2 or 3 of them.
But what was to happen with all of his stuff was kind of a turmoil. And he had a longstanding lady friend who moved to North Carolina. And I've been in correspondence with her almost on a monthly basis now for several years. And she feeds me stuff. Like the statue. I now have a big part of his library and all of his books, all of his textbooks in his library were full of notes and tip-in photographs where he would make a photograph to replace the one that was in the book. And I have those. And so what I want to do is I want to take all that stuff and do a Putzker manual. And I want to call it Putzker and the Pumpkin Patch. Because Ralph lived in Half Moon Bay, and one of his favorite workshops this year was Half Moon Bay has a big pumpkin festival. But I've got this stuff.
I'll help you do it.
Okay. I'll gather it up. I'll finance it. You have to design it.
I'll design it.
And but Putzker's teaching was revolutionary. He had 2 PhDs, one in education, one in psychology, both from Berkeley. And he was a psychologist, no question about it. He's a marvelous teacher. I've never met anyone that had the enthusiasm that he had. He just never had a bad day. Yeah. So he's gone, but he's not really gone.
I created a website about Ralph, and although it's not nearly as extensive as it should be, it's linked from my page.
Yeah.
And so we'll have to get a panoramic wrap of that, and then
we'll
put it up there as a QuickTime VR.
We'll do it. Mm. I see there's lots
no,
of
No, I
things.
Hadn't seen that. That's a remarkable.
Really?
It's so rough. I mean, the shutter alone is so rough.
Ralph, I don't know how many things he made for me. On the outside of his house, the one old one in Montero, there were two big doors, and when he opened the door, it was a machine shop, but it was only about 3 feet deep. So everything was in there, lathes and metalworking things. And I took him a pair of broken binoculars one time and asked him if he thought he could fix them, and he didn't fix them. He rebuilt it into a monocular. He threw the broken part away. So it's around here someplace. And the reason I have it is the World War I relic. It's rubber. So.
Is he the one that made those?
No, that was... They were good friends. This is Fred Buskirk, who's just retired from the postgraduate school. And
how do you spell his last name?
Buskirk, B-U-S-K-R-R-K. Fred.
Ralph was also building an airplane, and he was a pilot as well.
Yeah, he belonged to that group that met every year at Oshkosh, Experimental Aviation. And I don't know if you knew this or not, but Ralph flew aerial reconnaissance missions over Japan in the Second World War. And none of us ever knew that until Donna sent me all of his stuff, and all of a sudden here are these pictures. And the military papers, and he was a specialist in the aerial photography.
So, Brian was just up at Coy Tower, and I told him that Ralph, when he was very young, helped to paint a couple of the murals there and the one out at the Beach Chalet.
Ah, really?
That was a real experience.
Well, I think someone said something about, well, why do you teach? And one of the reasons is the wonderful experience for the students, of course, that come. But the other one is you never know who you're going to get to teach with. Mm-hmm. And usually it's pretty rare that they're a bad apple. Mm-hmm. It's pretty rare. Usually pretty good people. So now I spend most of my time with, when I'm co-teaching, I spend it with David Vestal in Connecticut. Vestal writes for several of the magazines. And I think is a very good photographer. And if you want a really good newsletter, this is what he puts out, it's called Kennedy. And it's all kinds of barbs about things that irritate him. And he's quite knowledgeable. And anyway, we do a workshop next year. It'll start in June. Here in Carmel, and it will wind up in July in Montana. And we just poke along, and we stop wherever the group feels like stopping, and we find a place, and then when we're tired of that, then we go to the next one. What do you think of that?
There's Al and Ralph teaching together. Let's see where.
Yeah.
I don't know where. Oh, I might say on the back.
And this woman now teaches for herself out of Sacramento. I didn't think of her name. 1978.
This photographic truce, a good photograph cannot be made in Fresno.
Yeah, well, I've now proven Ted wrong on that. My Manny Moe and Jack photograph qualifies as a good
Then behind it is the original one.
Here?
That's the first one he did.
Have you got the new digital one up there?
Yeah, the on the back of the
Indian. Older whiskey, younger women, faster horses, and more RAM.
Yeah. I see Ted all the time. Yeah.
I haven't seen Ted. Did his son just die of cancer?
Ted's son died at 44 from cancer. And
so he did pass away. I knew he was up there with him.
Yeah, he's pretty sick for a long time. But people like Ted, who did this, and Stephen, they all came up at the same time. Either Ted was at UCLA and Steve was at San Francisco State, and Norman Locks was at the Art Institute. And so I've had the giggling pleasure of watching all these youngsters turn into gray-haired people. You know?
Yeah, snot nose my ass.
Yeah, that's true. Anyway.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about this and what the idea was?
Well, not much of a book. But it's, I found that most people that call me with questions, the things that are really bothering them are rarely photographic. It's usually, my wife won't let me buy this lens, or my husband doesn't understand why I need to go on a camping workshop with you. And the other things were, well, I'm going to do this someday. And my whole attitude is, when you decide that something needs to be done, you do it now.
Yes.
You don't wait till tomorrow. You do it right now. And my example in here, right early in the book, is I had a banker that came with me for a number of years out of Sacramento. His name was Riddy. And he showed up at Kelso, and everyone else is in some kind of an SUV or Volkswagen van or something, and he showed up in a big Buick, you know. But he fell in love with riding around with me, and at that time I drove a Bronco. And he went with me, and he kept talking about, when I retire, I'm gonna get a Bronco, and I'm going to be a photographer just like you. And he came with me for two or three years like that. And every time he came, something would be changed. He'd have different clothes, or the Buick disappeared. And finally it got down to the point where he only had a year or two to go to retire, but he died. Hmm. He spent all those years working at a job that he didn't like. He never got to live. Mm-hmm. And to me, he should have told him to shove it the minute he understood it. And you just have to, that may not make sense to a lot of people, but it's one of the requirements and necessities of being in the creative circle, is the capacity to move when you know that it is right. And it isn't when someone else tells you it's right, it's when you tell yourself that it's right. You say, yeah, this is the time. I'm really lucky because I'm married to Susie, and I just celebrated our 40th anniversary. And I've had incredible support. One time I was, I don't know why I'm holding this down.
Because I wanted you to talk about it. All right.
I was sitting at the dining room table grumbling about something, and Susie walked by me and said, well, I think you need to go to the desert for a while. And my answer was, I can't right now, I'm too busy, I don't have the money. And she didn't say anything, but the next time she walked by me, she threw a $100 bill in front of me and just kind of kept walking. And I said, no, I appreciate it, I just can't make it, Sus. And so she put another $100 bill in.
Boy, I don't
make
those anymore.
Women on $100 bills. Oh, I don't know, maybe they do.
For 40 years, I've had that kind of support.
It's great.
And it's pretty neat. All these, every single one of these prints, she has handled. Wow. Every print has a stamp on the back of it, and she checks it against the original roster. She doesn't have to do that. I have other people who do it. But she wants to be a part of what's going on. Mm-hmm. After 40 years. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She up there?
Yeah.
And I'm going to say hello before we go.
Please do.
And so anyway, that's what the
book is about. It's about all the dumb little things that probably will bother you someday.
You take cash, right? Here's your...
I don't like
to pay sales tax?
I'm sorry?
Do I have to pay sales tax? Well, just in case I have to pay sales tax.
No.
I'll take care of that.
I know that when you go out...
Oh, desk copy.
...other places, they've already got something for sale, and I don't like that.
Thank you.
Could I see one?
I intentionally try to put these away.
Well, I'm glad digging them out.
Stephen brought these up.
Get another one. Get a copy of that.
Do you know the photographer Don Wirth?
Yeah.
Well, Don was a Mill Valley photographer, and gee, you know, you got another minute. I got another funny story for you.
Are you going to take two of those, are you?
No, I'm just going to take one.
All right, thanks.
I think this may be one of the most elegant books that's been done in the last... I'm still learning how to walk. Several years.
Wow.
Don Wirth. Don is an incredible photographer, and Don and I... Oh, thank you.
Thanks.
Is it even?
Yeah, that's what I feel.
This is for two.
Any change? Don and I were kind of the advisors to Steve on the Mona Lake thing, and he's at San Francisco State for his whole career. He was an outstanding musician besides a magnificent photographer. He had his own greenhouse.
Here's your mine. Thank you.
And,
I look forward to it.
A lot of the botanical things were done in his greenhouse. You know, he died last year. But before he died, Carol West did this book with David Gardner during the printing. And I honestly think it's the landmark book. It's a wonderful thing. And Don came down for a book signing, and the book is $100. So I asked him, I said, "Of that $100, Don, how much of it do you get?" This is the commercial photographer speaking now. And his answer was he got $8 out of $100.
Yeah.
The rest of it all gets pooped away with distributors and retailers and publishers and printers and all that kind of stuff. This little book right here, this book made me do this book. This book sells for $10. You know how much money I make on it?
How much?
Hopefully not.
$8.
Good for you.
I make the same on this as he made on him.
Now, how much did it cost to actually produce this book? This one.
How much did it cost him?
No, how much did it cost to produce it? The printing cost? And
my guess is probably close to $75,000.
But do you know what per copy? Do you know what?
Probably $50 to $60 a piece. Today, if you went to David Gardner, another friend of mine here, Richard Guerra, just had a similar, not quite as nice as this, but a very similar book. And for 1,000 copies, it cost him $25,000.
Oh.
So this is what a lot of photographers are doing today, like me. I no longer work with a publisher. I just go out and raise the money and do it myself. Mm-hmm. My next book will be on rock art.
Oh, great.
And it's done. The text is done. And the money's in sight. I have a designer in Northern California, and it'll be printed offshore. But
in China?
Formosa. Mm-hmm. But at the present time, we're looking at a press run. The book would be not quite this big, about 8 or 9 inches square. And my printing costs on it will be under $10,000.
For how many copies?
For 1,000 copies.
So it's $110 a copy?
Yeah. So, and this is a book that would normally retail, if it were through a regular publishing house, in the $50 to $60 range. So my thoughts is, I'm not going to sell it for $50 or $60. I'm going to sell it for $20. And I not only will it have a built-in market, but I'm going to make $10 a book. You know? And what that does is it also frees things. Like, I've already figured it out. If I print 1,000 of them, I'll probably give away 500 of them.
Yeah.
Friends.
Yeah.
Things that I need them for.
Yeah.
Advertising. It's much easier to walk into a museum or someplace to see a curator and hand them something that's worthwhile.
That's the Carol Williams Dodd's book?
Yeah, the Dodd's book.
This is beautiful.
It's just an incredibly beautiful book. If you're interested in one, the only place you can get it is at Carol Williams Gallery downtown Carmel. That's Photography West.
We're going by there tomorrow.
Oh.
You've already been there?
No, we're going tomorrow.
Okay, well, she produced it. And I don't think
$350, I think. I think it's $350, is that right?
You're kidding.
No, I don't think so.
Wow.
She might get a piece
Wow.
of it.
Well, Don's dead. Unfortunately, Don passed away a few months ago.
One thing I like about Carol Williams, she's got an eye for a dollar. So she made this investment, and when Don was alive. Mm-hmm. So then he dies, and so the book, instead of being $100, is $250, and she'll get it. She'll get it. Well, people like Don Werth and Pirkle Jones, Oliver Gagliani, you don't really hear about them in the same breath as a lot of the other high-profile photographers, but to me, they've always been the real backbone. They've always been the people that really knew what the hell the score was. And
I'd put Phil Hyde in that group, too.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Wow, look at that. Yeah. Just old rotting leaves. And look at that.
Well, gee, anyone want to buy one, maybe I'll sell them. Listen.
For $275.
But one of my thoughts, and I don't care whether you think I'm greedy or not, is that I really don't do very much unless I earn money on it or unless I really enjoy doing it. Mm. It's got to be one or the other.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's nice if it's both.
Yeah.
Mm. And I've never bought into this business that a photographer has to be a starving artist.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. You just figure out a way to raise your prices or do something, or sometimes the best way to do it is lower your prices.
Do you have a business manager?
No.
You're looking at him.
Yeah. My dad was an auditor for Greyhound Bus Line. And if you ever want to deal with a business that's a bunch of rattlesnakes, Greyhound is it. And my dad was a senior auditor for them. And I learned quite a bit from him. Yeah. So, but when I was in photo school, business administration. More business administration. Just so you at least could do a spreadsheet, you know. And, you know, sometimes someone calls and they want you to do a job, and you have to punch the numbers out, and sometimes it isn't worth it to do the job. The risk is too high, especially if I'm doing aerial photography. You figure, no, I'm not going to put a camera in an airplane for a job that only brings in $100, maybe, you know. It isn't worth it. That so many people just don't seem to grasp that. So that's what you talk about, what we talk about in the workshops. That's one of the things I like to talk about, is to be savvy about money. I don't think you have to be greedy, but you just have to be savvy about it, you know, just kind of know where it's going. The University of New Mexico Press wanted to do a rock art book for me, and they were real excited about it, so they said. But in order to do the book first, I had to give them $25,000 up front.
They were excited.
Yeah.
The prospect of getting $25,000 to subsidize
this
their book.
This is the same book that I'm telling you I'm getting printed in Formosa for under $10,000.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You figure, what does it cost me to raise $10,000? It doesn't cost that much. Two $5,000 caps. Do it every time.
Well, we sure appreciate your
time. One more thing.
Yeah?
Behind the rock art picture.
Yeah.
Another great California photographer, because they're out of San Francisco, but not that one.
One more?
The next one. This is in the frame. want you to see a real photograph of San Francisco. This is Halberstadt, who had a studio at 243 Vallejo Street in San Francisco. And he did this long series on San Francisco. This is only one of them. And it's called The Tone Line. And he comes out of the Bauhaus, the new Bauhaus in Chicago. Moholy Nagy was one of his professors. And on the far right, the still life is what he did for a living. The food photography. That's an advertisement done for Qantas Airlines. And that's what he did. But I show people these because there's always the argument about whether craft is part of the art or is art or not. Well, my argument is the craft really contributes to the art. And when you're on, you're really on.
Right.
And Halberstadt was always on.
And you got to be on.
Yeah. And that's it. Outside of sweeping out the dark room, we've done everything.
We sure appreciate your time, Al.
Yes.
Precious.
I've been sitting here waiting for you all day long.
Oops, I got my football game.
So, I hope, the rest of your trip goes well.
Thanks, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you very much.
Pleasure is mine, believe me.
Thank you very much, Al. This has been great.
Take the postcards, anything you see there. One of Jerry's is nice.